Hello, it's Julie Bindle, and it's been some time since I've brought you a podcast, but here it is. And today it's an interview with Dr. Pam Spurr. You may have heard of Pam when she was a media agony aunt for Breakfast TV back in the day. And then she was a radio presenter on LBC for 4.5 years, where she had the evening slot that Ian Dale presently holds. She has radio awards for her show at Heart FM, and she's been involved in all manner of charity work, anti-bullying, charities for people with attention deficit disorder. And she's written 15 self-help books on topics from happiness to dating, relationships and sex, dream interpretation, to emotional eating and other topics. And of course, we have got to know each other. Guess why? Because she is a casualty of the gender war. She has dared to say that biological sex is relevant to the lives of women and to men. And she's spoken out about it on the dreaded X, formerly Twitter. Here she is. So, Pam, you've written 15 books. Have you had time to do that?
Well, over quite a few years. The first one is in 1999, and it was about understanding your dreams. And then from up until 2015, I wrote the other 14. So it was over a spread of sort of 16 years. So it was sort of one a year. Obviously, the self-help market has boomed since sort of the 90s. And that's where I found a niche, writing about all sorts of things: dating, happiness, emotional eating, sex and relationships. So yeah, it took a lot of time, but I got them all done.
Well, tell me about your beginnings. So a bit about your life, how you came to be sitting here today with all these achievements behind you.
Well, I moved here when I was very young, first with my parents. My father was a professor and he was on sabbatical, and I was 14. Absolutely loved it. I graduated early from American high school and came back when I was 16. And because I'm an October birthday, I would have anyway graduated at 17, but I graduated 16 a year early and stayed with a family friend while I did a year at art school. And then I decided to change to psychology and started my BSc honors in psychology. At which point, in the middle of it, I fell pregnant. I am totally for pro-choice for women. At the time, I had that vigor of youth and I thought, I can have the baby. I'm unmarried, but I'm sort of on and off with the father, and I can finish my BSc. And I didn't realize, actually, it was still, despite my youth, it was a real challenge. You know, my family was in America. I only had family friends here. He was a very difficult man. And I didn't know if we would eventually get married. And we did. We got married when our son was about 15 months old. And then a little while later, after I started my clinical psychology degree, I was based at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And I found it really difficult. I finished my first adult placement there. But the man I was married to was a very controlling man and hated the fact that I would go off every morning to the Royal Free. We lived near Victoria, at Victoria Station. Spend a long day there. Our child was in daycare part-time, our son, and then part-time I had hired a sort of local woman who babysat. But he was not happy and he made it incredibly difficult for me to continue. So I finished my first placement, which was the adult placement in, you know, psychology at the Royal Free, left that, started a business, and then got pregnant with my second child, who was born with pulmonary disease and was very ill from three weeks old. I was really, really in a difficult position, because at that point, my then husband became even more difficult. I was really kind of trapped. two young children. He was the financial breadwinner at the time. And I did not tell people what I was going through. I had come from a family where my parents had a really good partnership. I had this great model of what a marriage or a cohabitation, a good one, should be like. And I felt ashamed that I'd ended up in something that was so very different to that.
Do you think that the shame was on you? Is that what was preventing you from speaking out, or was it fear, or was it a mix of the two?
I felt the shame in me that I'd landed myself in something that was so out of my experience of relationships. I was, here in England. My family were in America. So it was easy not to tell them the truth. And when we'd have visits, I would just pretend everything was fine until my daughter's third birthday. She had been very ill. She'd been in hospital. My parents had come over, and my ex-husband was, he was still my husband. He was away. He was off doing something. And I confessed to them. And I said, and they were stunned. They were like, why didn't you tell us? We would always be here for you. And I just said, I feel horrible that the father of my children is doing this to me. And yet this, I never saw witness this in my life growing up. And I felt embarrassed and humiliated. And now, of course, I recognize that so many women who get in these situations, they feel those things. They feel it's all about our mistake. It's never a mistake because I have two incredible children from this man.
Right.
But that my parents helped me at that point. They helped me kick him out. They helped me financially. I started working again. And it was a long road, because I did take him back. He stopped drinking. That was one of his big issues. And I took him back. And within 6 months, we'd had this year separation where he hadn't drunk. He started drinking again, and all the behavior started again.
So obviously this is a debate that's been raging amongst those that are concerned about domestic violence and abuse, that somehow it's the alcohol that is to blame. But would you concur with that, or would you say it's a disinhibitor?
Oh, it's a disinhibitor. He was absolutely, he could be as vile when he came back into the home with or without alcohol, but
right.
It quickly went back to the alcohol, and he would blame it on the alcohol. And I
right.
would say, you can't blame it on the alcohol, because even when you're not drinking, and then, I would be in trouble. So the police were amazing. One night he had held us captive in our home, and I had had a babysitter who lived near, and she had been visiting me when he arrived. I'd kicked him out at that point again. His brother had helped me change the locks, everything. His brother was a very fine man. And I had the part-time babysitter was sitting there with me when he came banging on the door, and she said, don't worry, I'll answer it. He's not going to do anything to me. No. Pushed her aside, came up, grabbed our son, put our son on his lap, held him there saying, if you don't take me back, I don't know what's going to happen. She ran out. The police station where I lived in Victoria, because then they used to have local police stations, was two roads down. Got the police, two guys arrived, calmed him down, got our son from him, got him out the door. And then they sat with me. And I have to say, this was like 91, 1991, and they were pretty darn with it, police officers. They gave me a direct line to the station and said,
which was the local station, Pam?
It was actually Belgravia station, but we lived right near the station. So
see,
it was,
I think that's interesting that you say that about the early 1990s, because I have a very strong sense, backed up by lots of evidence from feminist colleagues and friends all over the UK that are concerned about this issue, that we have gone backwards in policing domestic violence, and that the best time in terms of training and resourcing police officers to deal with this was the 1990s.
You are joking. Well, that
Well,
fits
it
perfectly.
began with specialist units. So I, sometime around 94, 93, I was working as a civilian in a North London police station in a
Yeah.
domestic violence unit. And specialism was the key word. It was that, look, okay, so, we all know the old mantra, domestic violence is a crime. And we would say, treat it like any other crime. Treat it in the way that you would if a man goes into a pub and beats another man up. Now, that's true. And it should be treated as a criminal offence, not an illness or his problem.
Exactly.
But the dynamic is different, as you know. And you can't pretend that there isn't something very specific about an intimate relationship or a relationship with the father of your child that is the same as a man in a pub or somebody at work. And so the specialism that was developed within police units was very, very important, because what those police officers were trained in, usually by the likes of us, by me and my other feminist cohorts, was about that dynamic, about the fear, about why she kept going back, about why she wouldn't leave, about coercive control, although it wasn't a criminal offence by then. So I'm glad that you had a decent police response. And
I
I'm so
do.
sorry for the women that aren't getting that decent response, because specialism has been disbanded and it's now no longer resourced.
And that is a tragedy because I know how hard it was for me as a, university educated with my family then all behind me, good friends who I had not even told until when I first told my family. And then local police who were there. I lucked out. And eventually the divorce went through in 1992 and got him out of our lives. And I survived that. But we know how many women don't.
Right.
And it cuts me up when I think I got out, I had the support, and so many women don't.
And was it, do you think, the experience and the fact that you survived the terrible, dreadful ordeal of this violent and abusive relationship that led you to down a particular path further on in life? Tell us what happened when you became free of that violence and moved on.
Well, I immediately signed up to do my MPhil at Guy's in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychology and Psychiatry, with a view to do my PhD there too. I immediately found a new lease of life just through my friends, and my parents would come when they could over from the States to just be there. My girlfriends were amazing. To this day, I've got the same girlfriends. And I said, I'm going to go do something and go back. I'm not going to go back to clinical, but I want to go back to researching children with issues and how to support those parents. And I did it. And it was hard. I was on my own with the kids for about 3.5 years before I met the man who became my second husband. But I just thought, he stopped me all those years ago from completing my clinical course. No one's stopping me from doing what I want to do now.
Right.
And then I trained as a parent advisor there too. I did a PTSD counseling course. I did all sorts of wonderful training on top of getting my doctorate there and doing some postdoc work with families. And then eventually at the Institute of Psychiatry on a PTSD project. But yeah, it was just about, and it's interesting you asked me that question, Julie, because I'll tell you, my faith in myself to get on and do something that I had been stopped from doing was strong.
Right.
My faith in men was destroyed. And
Yes.
my friends would say, well, let me set you up with a really nice guy. And I go, oh, I'm not ready. I'm not ready, And it took my dear friend, the late Dale Winton, who was like a big brother to me. We'd met doing some satellite or cable TV like in 1991. He'd seen me through the divorce. He just twisted my arm over many, many months that I had to meet someone he knew. And I used to say, Dale, I can't trust any man. You know what I've been through. And he said, I can guarantee you this man is not like that. He's also come out of a very bad relationship.
Right.
And he's just a great guy. And I finally agreed after Dale twisting my arm for months and months. And we had an introduction. And bingo, Dale was right. He
Good.
was.
I'm so delighted because obviously, as a feminist, my job is to just make sure that we don't kid ourselves that only the odd weirdo man is creeping around committing acts of sexual violence or abusing his kids or harming his female partner. But we know it's a very sizable minority. But we also know, and this is why I think feminism is such an optimistic movement for change, we know that men are not innately like this. And there are so many good men, there are so many decent men that are appalled at this. And I wish more of them would speak out.
Oh, I wish they would too. And I think part of it was the thing about that Dale did for me, for the first 6 months of having introduced me to this new person, he just held my hand because he knew my trust was broken with men. And all my girlfriends then met him, and they all agreed, oh no, he's a really nice guy. There's no side to him. This is your karma. You've gone from this horrible man to he's just a great guy, you know. And so what is it, 28 years later? Yeah, we're still together.
Well, Mazel Tov, and this I do like happy endings to especially traumatic events when there are young children around. Of course, it compounds the effect of domestic abuse, doesn't it? But what I'd really like to talk to you about is PTSD, is post-traumatic stress disorder, because I know a bit about this because I've been involved in looking at violence against women for a long, long time. It's inescapable when you do the work I do. And also, I've campaigned for many, many women in prison as a response to male violence,
Yes.
and met and spent time with and are friends with many that would fit the diagnosis. But what has been really worrying me and making me quite angry lately is the way in which this is self-diagnosed by some quite narcissistic personality types who throw this around, adding the complex bit to the beginning,
Yes.
as though having any kind of bad experience means you've got this and you can self-diagnose. Now, please just, tell our listeners what it is and how it comes about. What's the criteria for being diagnosed with this?
Well, there's quite a criteria, and you need to get a professional diagnosis, but it includes, flashbacks, excessive anxiety, being easily triggered, things that go along with that excessive anxiety, like insomnia, panic attacks, particularly with the triggers, if something, triggers you. That relates to what you've been through. It's like a good thing, like my daughter, when she was 15, got hit by a car that ran a red light, had very traumatized. And her best friend was with her. They both went up in the air, landed on the pavement. Now, they both reacted very differently to that experience. Neither was diagnosed with PTSD afterwards, but neither of them could say if a drama was on TV and we were hanging out as a family, a car comes along, smacks into someone, and the drama, both would be quite horrified, but otherwise kind of escaped. It might have been their age, although children, of course, get PTSD. But they didn't have the accompanying sort of, it was a one-off trauma, and then an extensive trauma that, say, someone who lives with domestic violence goes through. So they had that resilience that people who are diagnosed with PTSD don't tend to have that resilience for whatever reason. It may have been ongoing trauma. So their bank of resilience has just gone so far in the red. They have no strength, and they end up in full-fledged with a PTSD. So yeah, I mean, you have to get a professional diagnosis, but the key things are the flashbacks, night terrors, triggering easily, anxiety, insomnia, maybe turning to self-medication, alcohol, drugs, because you just aren't dealing with whatever the trauma was, whether it was
And
an organ.
as you say, usually a very frightening or near death experience, an experience that could kill you. Now, if you are a woman in a domestic violence relationship, it's constant. You're living on a knife edge, you're walking on eggshells, you're in a constant state of high alert, high anxiety. And then one day he picks up a knife or he just strangles you for that bit longer than you normally would. That is enough to push over that stress and anxiety into a full-fledged PTSD response, isn't it? Because this is the way that I can't bear this kind of, as I say, self-diagnoses based on something that isn't actually part of a pattern, as you say about your daughter with the resilience and the fact that this was a one-off experience. For somebody who was being driven around by a maniac who constantly took risks on the road, always thinking they were going to die, and then something happens, such as a car crash, being run over, might push it into that. But I was talking recently with another expert on PTSD, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Fiona Mason, who has treated many women with this diagnosis who are written off by the mental health system, such as we have it.
Yes.
It's on its bare bones, as you know, who have been also diagnosed with what they call personality disorder or severe personality disorder. Now, this is bloody well meaningless. It's a write-off for women who've suffered the most horrendous sexual violence and brutality in childhood, usually coupled with severe neglect. Women in prostitution routinely have this diagnosis, and yet it's so misused and overused.
But I think we have a problem with that generally, Julie. I think, a lot of people say with access to the net diagnose themselves with, generalized anxiety disorder or PTSD or, CPTSD, OCD, all these things that people talk about. And then they go online and think, oh, and that suits me. So I think there's also a massive issue in this area with self-diagnosis.
As with autism and ADHD, where many parents are self-diagnosing their kids, it could be other factors such as playing out certain behaviors because of abuse that's happening to them at school or bullying. And all of a sudden, their kid has autism and there's been no diagnoses. And then, I know I see on Twitter, on X, often with people suggesting that they might now be neurodiverse because it's the new cool kind of thing to have, and a million miles away from the reality of dealing with it as a parent or dealing with it as that individual experiencing it.
I think a lot of people feel it's better to label themselves than to and just take that and run with it than to actually find out what's going on.
I think that's right.
In some sense, to give yourself a label without looking at actually what is going on. Funny enough, I was in denial about my own dyslexia. It was only at Guy's Hospital when my supervisor said to me, Pam, you're always reversing things. Did you know you do this? And I went, no, I hadn't really noticed. He said, you're always, we ought to get you checked out by the cog psych people here. And I got a late diagnosis at like 32 of
Oh, really?
dyslexia. Now I recognize it
At
and I see it all
32,
the time.
gosh, that's incredible. So, okay, so look, we've established the fact that you are not just a survivor, but you have thrived in your life and you've overcome many obstacles. What made you start writing children's books? How did you get to that stage?
Well, I'll tell you where I got to that stage. I hadn't even thought of a children's story until my first granddaughter arrived just over 7 years ago. And we were big readers in our family. And of course, we had all the little baby books that just have little shapes and whatever, cute little faces and whatever on them. And I just started thinking of stories for her and started writing them down. And then next granddaughter came along, who's now 4 and a half, and wrote, funny enough, the story that's just been published was one of the ones I wrote for her. And littlest granddaughter, who's 2, I've also written stories for her. So it all came about. My agent started knocking on doors when I had sort of finished about 5 of them. Totally turned down. He had 12, 13 knockbacks from children's publishers saying, "Oh, Pam's known for adult self-help. She's going to be very difficult to place in this market. People think of her, she's done radio shows about sex." I mean, as if sex, as if we're in the Victorian era and sex is like a big scary thing. So, and then finally he found one who bought the story and said, "Well, we'll run with it." And that was like number 14. It took about 2 years. He started, I think he first started pitching the ones from my oldest granddaughter about 5 years ago. And yeah, it took that long.
I so love children's stories. My favorite is Six Dinner Sid. Do you know that one?
I know of it, but I've not read
It's
Six Dinner Sid.
incredible. Six
I
Dinner
know the
Sid.
title.
So it's a cat who just is one of those felines that ingratiates himself with all the neighbors and members, and he has six dinners a day because he just trots around the neighborhood saying, "I still haven't been fed."
You've just described my Arthur, who's now, sadly, he's an aging warrior now and he doesn't visit the neighbors as much, but he used to just do that. And he's such a lovely, friendly, big, gorgeous cat that they all would just go, "Oh, of course we'll give you some treats."
My Reggie, who died 3 years ago, he was notorious in the neighborhood because he would go missing constantly, always out on adventures, going into households where there were other tomcats, stealing their food, sleeping on the bed, pushing the other toms off, coming back home eventually. Scandalous behavior. But he was like Six Dinner Sid. I think it's probably why I returned to reading that children's book that I've always loved. Okay, so tell me about your media career, your radio and TV career. And of course, I'm interested in your bust up with Davina McCall. We all are. I'm sure that the subscribers, the listeners will then realize how you and I are on each other's radar.
Well, let's see. So the first time I was asked to, a friend rang me, it was like 1991, something like that, and said, "I know a Ken." She worked in the media. She said, "I know a cable TV company looking for a psychologist to talk about phobias." And I hadn't started my MPhil yet, but I had my BSc honors under my belt and I had the 6 month adult training. And it wasn't like I was going to be talking to people who were struggling. They just wanted someone to talk about phobias. And that's where I met Dale Winton, because he worked for the same company
I've
doing.
met him. What a lovely man. What a
I know.
really, really good man he was.
He was a very good man. And he fussed over my children because, of course, they were kind of fatherless. So I started doing those slots, and then I got asked onto a mainline TV company, which at that point was GMTV. Yeah, it's now GMB, isn't it? And did some talks about, by then I'd started my MPhil. I was talking about child welfare and things like that. And yeah, it just escalated from there. And then my agent at the time called me up and said, "Heart Radio are looking for an agony aunt. Do you want to go for the test?" And I said, "Sure." I was a bit young to be an agony aunt. I can't remember. I think I was about 34. But he said, "That's not gonna, they're not gonna worry about that. It's a young, upbeat, music station and blah, blah, blah." And I went along and just had the time of my life for 5 years there. People used to say, "You're the first gay positive, first sex positive radio show." We'd spent so much time with, young gay LGB youth who didn't know how to come out to their parents. So many phone calls about that issue. So many phone calls about, bad sex lives, and what can I do to make it better? And I always started with, do you know your own body, especially for women? Women are really bad about knowing their own bodies. And until you can pleasure yourself, no partner's going to be able to do it. So spent a lot of time on masturbation. And it was just, I had a blast, and I had a lovely co-presenter the first couple of years, and then they split us, and he continued to do his other show, and I did just the Agony show. And yeah, and it just, that's when I was invited. Then I was there for 5 years, and then went to LBC for 4.5 years, which was a very different show at LBC. I really loved it, but it was very demanding. It was the slot that Ian Dale is in now. It's the Monday to Thursday, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. It was kind of a magazine show, but it gave me what I've always said. My mother was a real activist. As a little girl in the 60s, my mom was involved in so many women's organizations, on marches all the time, because you can imagine the pay parity issues at those days. Whereas I always felt, I always called myself, when I discussed it with my friends, I just called myself kind of a lived feminist. Because when I was at Guy's, I made a point of mentoring younger women psychologists. When I got to do the magazine show at LBC, I made a point of bringing on younger women doing Agony type work, having them as a weekly guest, and just trying to empower the generation even younger than me. And I was a young Agony. That was a long time ago, though, now. So I've always tried in that way to bring up the ones below me, in that sense. But no, that's how it all started off. And then I was offered the first book,
And how did you start speaking about issues that could be now described as part of the culture war that we're living in?
Well, you mean when did I get peaked and start talking about
Let's talk about when you got peaked. That's always a good way to pick out the issues.
I'll tell you, in about 2015, I noticed that Stonewall had added the T to the LGB. And I thought, well, I'm not part of the LGB, but I have a lot of friends who are part of the LGB. And I used to think, what has the T got to do with LGB, with same-sex attraction? I really couldn't get my head around it. But I kind of thought, well, it's not my place to query this. But soon after that, probably about 6.5 years ago, someone had talked about chest feeding down in the Brighton Health Authority. And I put out on Twitter, as it was then, well, I breastfed my children, and anybody who feeds their children through their breasts is a breastfeeder, not a chest feeder. And I was really quite incensed, but I still didn't realize what was happening, because having had such an unstable life until my mid-30s, and then getting into a stable relationship, and still, obviously, my daughter's chronically ill, so that's always been something, a feature that we've had to deal with. But I then was so enmeshed in like proving myself, like getting to Guy's, doing my work, getting my qualifications, that I hadn't really been paying attention to what was going on. But then I was listening to James O'Brien on LBC about 4.5 years ago, and he was talking about J.K. Rowling. And he wasn't really committing to one side or the other, but he said, I'm kind of appalled, no matter what your opinion is, the trolling she's getting. And I looked it up, and online I went, whoa, J.K. Rowling is getting met. My kids loved her books. And I was like, this is insane. So I put a tweet out saying, I've just been listening to James O'Brien, LBC, and he mentioned that J.K. Rowling is getting trolled. You know, whatever your opinion is, this is not right. This is horrific. Oh my goodness, I invited the trolls in with that. So I got horrifically trolled. I wasn't ready for it. And I kind of thought, okay, I'm not doing that again for a while. And then within about a year, with the arrival of maybe my second granddaughter, I was like, oh, F this. I'm not staying out of this. I've got two granddaughters. They are going to be in a much worse place than I've been as a woman. And I think I've been had to go through pay parity issues and stuff. Sexism at work, I've had to go through that. I don't want them to go through that. And that's when I got peaked and thought, for them and all children and women and the LGB, this is not right. what's going on.
Good for you. Most people without a direct skin in the game, and actually most people with skin in the game, don't ever speak out. Some because they would lose their jobs and their income, or their loved ones would suffer. But some because they're cowards, and some because they just don't care, and some because they see it as a good way to kick the feminists because we've gone too far. And
Oh,
I just
yes.
appreciate everybody that speaks out about this when you don't have to.
Well, I just was enraged. I was enraged to hear that little girls could be competing with little boys at sports. I was enraged to hear that they were transing away the gay from gay children. I was enraged that women's words, our words, were being taken away, that ourselves are being taken away, that anybody with a certificate could be recognized as a woman. I was like, no, this ain't happening. It's just, I've got to get in this. I have had a lot of issues to deal with because of it, but I've only lost acquaintances, no true friend. Even the friends who don't quite aren't on the same page, they are still friends. But there have been so many acquaintances, particularly in the media, a lot of the media people that I've interacted with a great deal of the years have just wham, you're
Oh,
out of my contact book. You know, it's like,
completely. And Davina McCall blocked you on Twitter, as it was then. Why?
well, what happened was I'd met her probably four or five times because I was one of the main Big Brother contributors as a behavior expert for about 13 years or so. I had worked with her a couple times there and met her a couple other times when we were doing different bits of these shows. So, you know, we did know each other. And I simply tweeted her saying, please, Davina, why are you pandering to non-binary women, as you're calling them, or non-binary people, asking them for their menopause stories when you're talking about women? And I said, you know, a lot of women are now not going to buy your book. Something like, please think about this, exclamation, exclamation mark. And she just blocked me. I mean, it was a forthright tweet, but it wasn't a rude tweet. It was just a kind of like, think about it, please. You know.
It's extraordinary because you asked her a question about something that many of us would be are so offended at, that you know the language that we have learned to use, having been told as children to use euphemisms for our bodies because female bodies are somehow unacceptable or dirty or unpleasant, and then we get to use the words and we get comfortable with the words if we're lucky, and then we're told not to use them anymore. And she was clearly part of that problem, and she couldn't take it from you. She couldn't take your criticism or even just your robust question. That's disgraceful for a public figure.
Well, I think it's shocking how public figures with huge platforms are captured like that. And who knows what someone like Davina actually thinks about these issues. For all we know, her publisher said that in this book, you have to include a chapter for non-binary people. And she went along with it rather than fighting it. I don't know. She may embrace it. I just don't know. But because I didn't have any answer back, and I think she then ended up on a blocking spree from memory. This was, I don't know, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, something. And I just think it's so irresponsible, you know. I try not to be angry with people who aren't out. I do know some women cannot come out with these views because they will lose their job. A number of people I follow on Twitter who have, you know, fake profiles, we message each other and they talk about, as soon as I leave my job, I'm coming out, but I can't risk it right now. And I go, I will be here for you when you come out. And if you get trolled, because so many people have helped me when I've been trolled and they've come on and, you know, it's better when you've got, you know, a lot of people who are saying, no, come on, you know, you can't be like that. You can't troll like that. That's horrible, you know, because you know what the trolling is like. We get called words I don't use and told that we all look like, I'm constantly told I look like a trans woman. I don't care what they think I look like. I could not care. And I always come back with, That is what a kindergartner would say. Why would you say something like that? Why would you comment on someone's looks? Because you don't have an argument.
Absolutely. But look, that they are so losing the battle, the extremists. They've gone way too far and piqued the nation, pretty much. But tell me what you're doing now. Let's talk about what you're up to and what your next moves are.
Well, obviously, right now I'm promoting Eva the Bear and the Magic Snowflake, which is based on my middle granddaughter, who is.
We'll have the link to that in the show notes. So you say it's based on your middle granddaughter.
Yes, she's full of gusto. She does footy twice a week. She's just, one of these characters who just, is out there, and she's, just embraces huge life and adventures for a 4-year-old. So Eva the Bear captures her personality. Her name is Eva, and her nickname from when she was 6 months old was the Bear, because she used to try and hurtle herself instead of crawl.
Brilliant. She
I think
sounds
maybe she's a future
fantastic.
lioness.
I'm going to read that book. I need something. I can't keep reading Sixteen the Cid when I need to sort of calm myself
I'll
down and
send
get
you
in a
a
happy
copy.
place.
I'll send you a copy happily.
I would love to read that book. And so you're promoting that. And then what's next for you?
Well, what's next is I'm still painting, although less because I've had sight loss due to the accident to my left eye. So I'm painting now more to commission than actually just generating like I was when I got back into painting 4 years ago. I generated enough pieces to be involved in exhibitions, but then I had the accident and I lost my sight in my left eye, and I've had three operations, which has restored some of it. So it's more difficult, but I am fulfilling commissions, which I love doing. So I can do that at the right pace. I can just take a commission and do that. And just getting as involved as I can in this, I call it a fight to, I've been writing the MPs, I've been writing the PM, all this thing like the consultation about the schools with Gillian Keegan. Of course, I put in my two bits on that. But my big fear, Julie, is the 2019 Relationship, Sex and Health Education Act enshrined teaching gender identity to children. And I think that's the wrong way of going about this. I think children should learn about respect for themselves and each other in relationships, learn what a good relationship it is, learn what the biology of sex is at the appropriate time. But I do not think they should be taught that you could be in the wrong body. I think that's wrong for young children. If an adult wants to make that decision, that's up to them, as long as they don't come into women's spaces. If they're a man who identifies as a trans woman, I take the J.K. Rowling line, you live your best life, but you have to look at and respect other people's rights, But in school, no. Children should learn to celebrate their unique qualities. I taught my children, both who have their own quirks, embrace it. You are you. You do you. Your personality, let it shine through. And I think all children should be taught that. You are unique. You don't have to label yourself from one of the 58 genders that the Irish government goes by. You don't have to label yourself by the 72 gender labels that one of the medical organizations online goes by, or the 110 labels. Don't have a label. You don't need a label. You're just you.
Well, I think that is a superb note to end on. Obviously, everybody buy the book. As I say, we'll put the links to Dr. Pam Spurr's work in the show notes. But I'm really glad that we've got to have this conversation, Pam. It's lovely to get to know you a little bit, and we should do this again sometime.
I just loved the fact that you accepted me on your podcast. Thank you so much. I have such admiration for the work now that I know a lot more about you and the work you do. Especially as a survivor of domestic abuse.
Well, I appreciate everything you do and speaking out and making it clear that there is life beyond those horrendous circumstances. And you've overcome such a lot. So thank you. And it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. Until next time.